riot in Ukraine. And these are images that you need to see for yourself. Here they are.
And China uses the TikTok algorithm to promote its narratives. They have used every channel to poison the minds of Americans.
We're going to have all of this on the Sanchez effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to begin with a developing story. I want you to take a look at some of these pictures. And by the way, on our show yesterday, we had someone on suggesting that what you're about to see was about to happen. And now it's happened. Here it is. Watch. Yeah, this is crazy. This is how it started, by the way. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people took to the streets in Ukraine. Look at these scenes. This is in the city of Lvov, right, by the way. Angry protesters, seemingly filled with rage, angry about the war, angry about their government, angry about the forced mobilizations. In fact, these were triggered by one of those forced mobilizations. Police officers, some wearing like these green shirts, some in plain uniforms. I mean, some in uniforms, some in plain clothes. They're recruitment officers, and they show up and they try and drag people off the streets to the front lines when no one's looking. Well, this time they were looking. The crowd saw it. They started chanting, shame, 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 shame. Then they started chanting, bastards. And then things got really crazy as they overturned this car. They started some fires. And the reason this story is particularly timely is because just yesterday, right here on this show, we played a clip of Doug McGregor suggesting that this very thing would soon be happening.
It may ultimately collapse before Russia gets a chance to crush it. I mean, it's that bad inside Ukraine. More and more desertions every day, larger numbers of units, more people leaving the country. Press gangs running out of control, trying to drag in anybody they can find.
It's kind of crazy that he said this thing would happen, which is the opposite of what they're saying in the West. They're saying Ukraine is winning the war and the people of Ukraine are happy and the people of Russia are upset. It's obviously the opposite. This is not happening in Russia. Pictures like the ones that you just saw right there. I would know, right? Okay, now we got to talk about what's happening in the other theater. This is the situation in Iran. The fighting, as you may have heard, is back on. And I'm going to explain to you why this is happening. And it's all about, once again, the Strait of Hormuz. And this is the Strait of Hormuz, and we put it right here for you. Do you remember in the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, paragraph 5, paragraph 5 said the United States has agreed to the fact that the Iranians would control the Strait of Hormuz, this little area right here, which looks big in this picture. In reality, it's pretty small. They would control the Iranians this for the next 60 days, right? For the next 2 months. Well, it looks like the United States has tried to find a way around that by establishing another corridor, right? Within the Strait of Hormuz. And this other corridor would be one that's closer to Oman. In fact, you see it here in white, right? See that white bordered line that we put for you right there? They call this the Southern Corridor. So they call that the Northern Corridor and this the Southern Corridor, right? Thereby essentially taking Iran's exclusive control away from them, or at least trying to split it in half. Of course, Iran, that you see up there, is saying, no, we're not going to let that happen. Which is why yesterday, or within the last 48 hours, they fired a warning shot at one of the ships that was trying to enter through this southern corridor. They didn't hit it, they didn't blow it up, but they fired into it, right? To show that they're not going to allow this second corridor to take place. Well, that, of course, is what led Mr. Trump to this rant.
Is the ceasefire done? Is the MOU dead?
It's a very interesting question. To me, I think it's over. I don't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. You know what scum is? They're scum. They're sick people. There's something wrong with them. They're cuckoo.
It's easy to understand why this situation is making Mr. Trump crazy mad, right? Because essentially the whole thing has backfired on Mr. Trump and the United States. In fact, many would argue that the Strait of Hormuz itself, this area right here, has become, and you've heard this said, it's become Iran's nuclear weapon. It gives them complete tactical superiority in this war, which is why they are determined to hold on to it. Here's Trita Parsi yesterday when he was trying to explain this point. Take a listen.
The U.S. interpretation and the interpretation of many of the GCC states, including those that are actually quite close to Iran, is that it is not saying that Iran alone should be doing this, that Iran does not control the strait, that there is a southern corridor and that's where it goes through Omani waters. And if ship wants to go through that, they can do so without coordinating with the Iranians. Now, the Iranians are very suspicious of this because they fear that that southern corridor is deliberately being created in order to make sure that if war resumes, this time around, the Iranians can't close the Strait of Hormuz. And given how important that was as a leverage point for them, they're a bit paranoid about anything being done that will take that away from them.
So there you go. Donald Trump, as the Iranians see it, and as Mr. Parsi just explained it, is trying to find a way to do just that, trying to find a way around the agreement, trying to find a loophole, if you will. So last night after the show, I called on Elijah Monnier. He's one of the smartest analysts on this area with knowledge of the deal, knowledge of the region. And he came on my live stream and he and I had a conversation where he explained to me what the U.S. is trying to do more specifically and why the Iranians, he thinks, are not going to let them get away with it.
He needs to let the Strait of Hormuz to the Iranians and the Omani, and he doesn't want to. And he's trying to find an alternative through Oman, and this is what he has been doing, putting pressure on Oman to enlarge their water and say, and push all the tanker, well, this is what happened yesterday, the Saudi, the Emirati, and the Qatari, to go through Oman and avoid the Iranians because he wants to take away the Strait of Hormuz card from Iran. The Iranians are not stupid. They're not going to allow him to win on any level. He is the one who killed their leader. He killed more than 5,000 Iranians, and he destroyed a lot of infrastructure and started an unlawful war, thinking that he can change everything.
So here's the question we're left with then. Is there a possibility that the war between the United States and Iran could then escalate once again to proportions maybe even more dangerous than what existed before? I asked him about that, and according to Elijah, the answer is no. Why? Because, to use a very Trumpian phrase here, the Iranians, because of this, are holding all of the cards.
The Iranians are very clever, and they're going to walk along knowing that the return of hostile activity can be resumed, but not a full-out war, because the Americans don't have any objective to fulfill.
Here's what he means by that. If the United States escalates the war, it would be, in essence, re-blocking the Strait of Hormuz. It's impossible to escalate the war without doing so, right? Which is exactly what caused Mr. Trump to cry uncle and go back to the negotiating table in the first place. But it gets worse. And I'm going to explain this to you here by changing the map. We're going to go to a bigger map now, and I'm going to show you that it's not only about one strait, there's actually two straits involved here. This, that you see right here, this is the Strait of Al-Mandab. It is what the head of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, usually recently called a hydrogen bomb. So if this is a nuclear bomb, they're saying this is the hydrogen bomb. And right now, it is also under threat because Yemen, seen right here, geographically controls that tiny little opening that goes into the Red Sea and goes into the Mediterranean right now. They are threatening again to shut it down. Remember, Yemen is an ally of Iran, right? And Yemen is, as we speak right now, going at it once again with Saudi Arabia by threatening their airport and their seaports and their sea lanes. This is how Saudi Arabia gets much of its oil into the world. Can you imagine? In fact, you know what? The Strait of Mandab, based on what I just talked about, just through Saudi Arabia alone, may be an even more vital source or a vital pathway than the Strait of Hormuz. 9 billion barrels of oil alone flows through here every single day. That's a lot. It's how cargo, not just oil, gets into the Mediterranean. Goods travel through ships right through. They go in through here or out through there. They go through the Red Sea right there. Then they go up. See up there? That's the Suez Canal. And then they go into the Mediterranean. So think, I mean, duh, right? Think about what would happen if both the Strait of Hormuz and the Strait of Al-Mandab, both this one and this one, are shut down. A fourth of all the world's oil, all the world's gas, all the world's fertilizer, all the world's chemicals would not be able to get in and out of here or in and out of there, right? In some cases, ships would have to try to find an alternative route, which means to go all the way down around the Horn of Africa. What's that going to cost? Months to get through there? To get back to here? I mean, this would be, most experts say, an economic catastrophe. All right, let's get back to the sitting position so we can talk about the next big story, which is in Ankara. NATO countries continuing to push for war with Russia. The U.S. pushes for a continued war with Iran. That's the background. Back home in Neocon Central, the United States of America. By the way, Neocon Central is what I tend to call the cable news channels, Fox News, CNN, NBC, because that's what they represent, neocons. They're also pushing for a war, but what the war they're seemingly pushing for is with China. The scare tactics about China are nothing if not spectacular. I mean, it's enough to make most people listening. If you're an American and you just turn on your TV and you listen, it's like, oh, my God, the Chinese are coming. In the UK, they're saying, oh, my God, the Russians are coming to rape our wives. In the United States, it's the Chinese communists are about to invade us. It's crazy. It's crazy. Here's a segment. I want to show you what they're saying, actually. This is a segment on how Chinese communists are invading the United States. Watch.
China is so much more active in the information space than we are. And think about where that generation is getting their information. Overwhelmingly, it's TikTok. China controls those algorithms. And so they're controlling what those younger viewers or consumers, rather, are learning about China. And they're not obviously learning about their, you know, genocide against the Uyghurs. They're not learning about the fentanyl coming into the United States, killing a lot of our young people. This is communist China we're talking about. Mm-hmm. They're putting the best possible face on totalitarian communism. I didn't think there was one, but they're apparently fairly effective at it. And that's what we have to combat.
Crazy. All the buzzwords, right? Communists, genocide, killing our young people. I mean, it's all there. I mean, most of it is, I mean, at worst, an absolute bald-faced lie, at best, arguable, but it gets worse. Or better, there's more crazy talk to show you. This comes from none other than Gordon Chang. So Gordon Chang is the guy with the Chinese name who the Western media can always rely on to hate on China on TV. I know this because I used to work at these cable channels, all of them, right? And I remember always being told that I have to interview Mr. Chang whenever there was a story about China. And I always found it really curious that this guy would come on and he never had anything good to say about China. Nothing. And here he is, once again, true to form, sounding off on how China is, as my mother, God bless her, used to say, eating America's brains.
Clearly, and China uses the TikTok algorithm to promote its narratives. Right after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we saw all of these pro-Russian narratives. There have been pro-Hamas narratives. 96.5% of the videos on Hamas, on TikTok, support that terrorist group. And that really indicates why we have all of these protesters on our college campuses promoting barbarism, torture, murder of Hamas. So it's very clear. They have used every channel to poison the minds of Americans.
It's very clear. China's with the Muslims, and we all know that Muslims are all radical terrorists. And they're with the Russians, and we all know the Russians are all coming to rape your wives. So if you like China, you're with the Russians. And if you like the Russians, you're with China. And if you like China, you're with the Muslims. I mean, this is the circular argument that he creates, and this is what people in the United States have to hear every single night if they turn on CNN or Fox News. I wanted you to experience it for yourself. It's crazy talk, but that's what they say. By the way, never mind that in actuality, TikTok is really essentially owned by Israel, not China. In fact, Prime Minister Netanyahu has recently been bragging about this. Of course, if Israel controls what Americans think, that would be perfectly fine, right, Mr. Chang? Finally, score one for the good guys. Maybe. Hasn't happened yet. But it looks like Senator Mitch McConnell is on life support. Obviously, I'm not saying that because I want any harm to the man. That would be wrong, and I would never do something like that. I'm saying it not from a personal standpoint. I'm saying it from a geopolitical standpoint, from a change standpoint for the United States. I mean, the guy's 84 years old. Mitch McConnell's been fainting in public lately. He's been having mini strokes. He has had seizures in front of the camera. It's tough to watch. Now he's been in a wheelchair. He's old, he's feeble, but he remains one of the most powerful votes in the U.S. Senate, if not the most powerful. He's profoundly pro-war, profoundly anti-China, profoundly anti-Russia, anti-Iran, anti-Muslim, steadfastly pro-Israel. And he's received, of course, millions and millions of dollars, donors. He's one of the richest guys in the Senate. He started with nothing. Now he's a multimillionaire. And he got most of his money from Israel and from the weapons makers. A few days ago, though, he was wheeled out of the Senate, and people who saw it say it was bad. He's unconscious, he was barely breathing, and reports are now circulating he's on life support, and he's likely not going to make it. He's certainly not going to make it back to the Senate. Some are even suggesting that he really has already passed away. Okay, so why is that such a big deal, and why am I telling you about it? Here's why. According to the law in Kentucky, which is where Mitch McConnell is a senator, they're going to have a special election to replace him. And the Democrats are going to put up a candidate, and the Republicans are going to put up a candidate, and those two are going to be exactly like Mitch McConnell, of course, right? And they're going to be paid by the same people. But now there's a push for a third candidate, right? An independent. And lo and behold, that third candidate, guess who it might be? Guess who they're pushing for? Thomas Massie. Massie, that guy. Kentucky congressman. This guy's the polar opposite of most U.S. senators, certainly the polar opposite of Mitch McConnell, but he could win. It would be huge, especially given his record. Massie is against interference in places like Iran and Russia and China. He's also on the record as refusing to take money from Israel, my God, which is why they recently attacked him and got him out of office. In fact, he seems to have, Massie does, this crazy idea that U.S. elected officials should serve the American people and not a foreign country. Nuts, right? When we come back, we're going to be talking to a rare breed of Turkish politicians who are opposed to their government's role in NATO. He's in Ankara, where the NATO meetings have been taking place, and he's going to answer the age-old question of what happens if Europe attacks Russia. They seem to want to. What would Turkey do? Should it? Join in. We'll be right back. Hello again, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. And now we want to do what we said we were going to do. One of the stories that we want to address is what's happening in Europe right now is a little crazy. And we want to examine it through the eyes of a Turkish politician. After all, NATO right now is meeting in Ankara, right? And he's not too far from there. He is joining us now, Mr. Kemal Okuyan. He's the General Secretary of the Communist Party of Turkey. Obviously has a hand in reaction to what his government is doing and what his government has done. Mr. Okuyan, thank you so much for joining us, sir. It's really nice that you're there. You're being very kind to give us so much of your time.
Hello, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. I'm just confused by what I'm seeing in so many different places. And I've been watching these NATO meetings that have been taking place in your country. And I'm somewhat flabbergasted by their bold approach to basically wanting to do everything possible to start wars and continue wars. And they seem, I don't know if you've noticed, hell-bent on going to war with Russia. I don't know why. And I'm just wondering, what is your position and what do you think is your country's position on this?
You see, our story started in 1952 with NATO, and it continued till now. But when we speak about things happening in Ukraine, our government, they did a good thing that they didn't participate in the sanctions, for example, against Russia.
Okay.
It was a good idea and it was a benefit for Turkey because, you see, we have to have good relations with Russia. Before it was Soviet Union, we are neighbors. We need economic relations, cultural relations, social relations. Mm-hmm. So it was a good idea. But since 2024, mainly after the elections, local elections in Turkey, we were expecting that a shift from that policy towards supporting Ukraine on material basis, I mean weapons, it's increased. Okay, till now, Turkey has not declined its relations with Russia, of course. It is not easy. Both countries need each other. But the NATO summit shows that Turkish government has passed the line. And they are now trying to be a more strong partner in the so-called defense of Ukraine.
Why are they suddenly acquiescing? What is it? I mean, is it because the arguments that are being made by somebody like Mark Rutte and Mr. Maersk and Mr. Macron and some of these people is so incredibly strong? Is it because maybe they're so good looking? I don't know. What the hell is it?
The main reason is Turkish economy is really in a bad shape. They need sources, and the sources are, of course, mainly in Germany, Britain, and United States for Turkey, because Turkey is traditionally strong relations. Turkey's finance system is basically related to Britain, and plus Turkish economy, the main partner is Germany. Turkey needs money. And there is another issue. Turkish defense industry, or what we call armed industry, is now becoming one of the locomotive sectors because Turkish economy has... They are trying to change the structure. Or they're really trying to change the strategy of the Turkish economy.
Let me push this to the critical point here. I understand that Turkey feels that it should be a country with a good defense. My God, you've got Iran next to you, you've got Israel, you've got the situation in Ukraine. I totally get that. I would understand why a country geographically positioned where Turkey is would be smart to be able to defend itself. But the question is it trying to build up its military to defend itself from forces that are, well, let me just say it, genocidal, like Israel? Or is it trying to formulate its defenses to be able to fight Russia, for example, which has meant Turkey absolutely no harm, at least in the last 100 years?
For me, I'm a communist. And for me, defense of a country starts with the people. You see, arms race or having an alliance with imperialist powers, that doesn't mean a strong defense or that doesn't mean a strong army. The issue here is, of course, this is economics, because defense industry is not only defense industry. It has relation with metal sector, chemistry, all the sectors. That is one issue. And Turkey realized that the new changes in the war theater all over the world, new weapons, drones. So Turkey started this earlier because, you know, they had war in Iraq, war in Syria, Libya. They participated in war in Azerbaijan, between Azerbaijan and Armenia. So they know that there are new waves of arms. And they introduced this to Turkish economy earlier than some countries. So that is why Turkey is now becoming an important exporter. I don't mean that Turkey has boomed its defense industry, but it is something. So, but they need to sell it to somewhere. Yeah.
Everybody's trying to make a buck. It's crazy. I wish they'd be more worried about the welfare of their citizens than they would be the welfare of the people who they buy and sell arms from and the bankers who do the deals. But that's, unfortunately, the world we live in. Let me show you these protests that have been taking place in NATO. Describe to me who these people are, how they came together, and what your role was in any of this, if any.
Yeah. Well, the government, interestingly, banned all the demonstrations in Ankara for nearly 15, 20 days. It is crazy. And then it banned the demonstrations in some other countries also, some other cities also. So we announced that we are not going to accept this. Because you see, NATO has always been protested in Turkey. And not only communists, there are some other forces who are against NATO, and it is a natural thing that we protest. And not only NATO, we protest for some other issues also. Yeah. And of course, Turkish government is now trying to avoid any protest. But we declare that we are not going to accept. There were some big demonstrations in Istanbul and in some other cities, but in Ankara, there were nearly a silence with some very small protests. But our party organized a protest in the center square in Ankara because we said that you cannot avoid this, because Turkey is a huge country with a huge population, and there are a lot of people who are against NATO. So, and that was, it was symbolically important. I'm not exaggerating, because we couldn't stop NATO summit. We couldn't change the course of the events, but it is important because it was all over the world. Even agencies like Reuters and some other agencies had to cover. So it is an important thing, and a lot of 139 of our party members were taken to custody.
Notwithstanding that you're part of the opposition of Mr. Erdogan, can you explain to us, what's he about? Who is this guy? He's fascinating. I haven't had a chance to interview him yet, but he's a pretty cool cat, and he seems to always know what to say. But what's his real game?
Well, you see, the game started 25 years ago. So he's one of the most experienced leaders in Europe or in the world, let us say. And he came to power with the full support, I mean, full support of United States, European Union, and some reactionary Arab countries. So the coalition in the world arena that supported Erdogan was something. And then you have to take into account the internal powers. He was supported by nearly all sectors of Turkish big capital, Turkish monopolies. So, and he followed a very strict line to please them. But ideologically, he comes from an Islamic party, and they have also a tendency for new Ottomanism.
New what? Is that? Sorry,
new Ottomanism. Oh. So he's trying to renew
autonomy, yeah.
The Ottoman or empire tradition. Mm-hmm. So that is why they had a friction with some Western countries, because the area here, the Middle East, the Balkans, the Caucasus region, there is rivalry. So it is not easy for Turkey to penetrate. So there was a friction. But now we realize that Turkey has decided to follow this new Ottomanist.
And you mean
strategy.
You mean Ottoman, like the Ottoman Empire is what you mean, not
yes,
autonomy.
Yes, that's true. Yes, a
Thank
new
you.
Version.
Yeah, of course.
A new version.
Yeah.
So under the NATO umbrella. So because they witnessed what is going on in Middle East, especially in Syria.
Yeah.
In Syria, the regime change was mainly was an outcome of a cooperation between Israel and Britain for us.
Yes.
And
yes.
Of course, Turkey supported.
So, but he's right. I mean, if he saw what happened in Libya, saw what happened in Iraq,
yeah.
saw what happened
yeah.
in Syria, and says, "Wait a minute, we're next," and then Iran, he's right to suspect that if they went after those countries, the next big country they want to take over, the Israelis, that is, with the help of the United States, would be Turkey. So he's
but
right
the
to...
the problem is...
Yeah?
Turkish governments, you know, in boxing, when you are trying to avoid the punch of your rival, you try to be close.
Yeah.
In order to avoid.
Yeah.
Turkey is always like this. They know what United States can do, because they know each other. And that is why their defense is to increase their relation with United States.
Well, what about the fact that the United States just got a big bloody nose from Iran? Are they cheering for Iran and saying, "Good job, Iran, way to go," or are they concerned about that? Because if they're allies with the United States, maybe they're sad for it.
You know, Turkey's main rivalry in the region is one is Iran,
exactly.
The other is Israel,
yeah,
and the other is Greece.
Huh.
So Turkey needs a weak Iran, but not a regime change, a weak Iran. And I think they achieved this because in Palestine, especially in Hamas, the leadership shifted from being more close to Iran to Turkey now. Hmm. That is one issue. In Syria, Iran lost, for sure.
Right.
So Iran is weaker than compared to 2 years or 3 years ago.
Well, because, but Iran is in there fighting the fight. Turkey is in the stands talking, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
It's true. And Turkey does not want Iran to be defeated, because then there will be more pressure to Turkey.
That's
but Turkey, Turkish government, needs a weak Iran.
I'm sorry, finish your point. That was terribly rude on my part. Please finish
your
point.
No problem. But Turkey, I think the government needs a weaker Iran, not a defeated Iran.
Interesting.
And they achieved this.
Let me ask you this. When I was in your country recently doing some reporting, I talked to people about this, and I said, I am always impressed when Mr. Erdogan talks about the genocide taking place in Gaza. He is as strong-willed and as forceful with his language as any person in the world. And then some of these people who I was talking to in my reporting said, "Mr. Sanchez, don't be fooled." I said, "What do you mean, don't be fooled?" He said, "He talks a big game, but when it really comes down to it, he's actually doing deals with the Israelis. Some of these roads, the construction was done with Israeli companies, for example. So this is a dragon talking out of both sides of its mouth. Is that true?
It's true. Well, of course, as I said, there is a rivalry between Israel and Turkey, and both are U.S. allies.
Huh.
And
are they allies? Is Turkey an ally with Israel? Would you say they're allies? Well, he's always criticized.
No, I say Turkey is an ally of United States,
yeah,
and Israel is an ally of United States.
But is Turkey an ally? But is Turkey an ally of Israel? Is my question.
In long term, yes.
Huh.
Because we have to. You see, observe the reality.
Yeah.
Did Turkey, for example, stop any trade with Israel? No.
No.
One of Turkey's main ally in the region is Azerbaijan.
Yes.
Which pumped a lot of oil to Israel during the massacre in Gaza.
Hmm.
Turkey did not stop this. And it went through the Turkish border. And the oil were transferred to Israel from Turkish ports, the Azerbaijani oil. So, but of course, I cannot say that the relations are smooth. No, it is not only theater. There are real rivalry. And United States is very, clever, U.S. administration, to use Israel against Turkey and Turkey against Israel, to use Turkey against Greece and Greece against Turkey. This is for many years, they have done this perfectly. And it is a pity that our governments fall in this trap.
By the way, I'm wondering what your opinion is of this. I would argue that Iran has won this war, and there is no way that the United States or Israel at this point can turn it around short of something like nuclear weapons, because it looks like Iran controls the Shia movement in many of these countries, like Bahrain and Iraq and parts of Pakistan. They now have all the leaders from all over the world coming to pay them homage for this incredible victory over America. Do you feel that way? Do most Turks feel that way?
In the society, yes, and I feel that the United States lost this war.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. Of course, Iran has other problems. The isolation is accelerating. They have problems. They have economic problems. But as long as you ask me the war, United States was defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a good thing, if United States is defeated. And in the society, Turkish society, I can say that there was a great deal of sympathy to Iran. Although we have, mainly there's a rivalry within the Islamic sects. They are Shiites in Turkey, mainly we are Sunnis. Huh. But there was a great deal of sympathy, yes.
Let me ask you another question now about the other theater. Let me ask you about Ukraine. The opinion of many very smart people like Professor Sachs and Professor Mearsheimer and others is that NATO did everything possible to provoke Russia into a war with Ukraine. I could tell you all the different things they did, but you probably know about them. The coup, the changing of the government, the pressure on the Donbass, the putting in military hardware, the threats to Crimea. And eventually, Russia felt like, we just can't allow you guys to take this country, which has been part of our history. So they went in to try and take back the Donbass, which is what's actually going on right now. Do you believe that to be the case? Or do you believe that Russia is just an animalistic, bullying country that for no reason went in there and wanted to expand its borders and invaded Ukraine? Which do you believe?
Well, NATO, you see, NATO, they say that it's an organization of defense and security, but starting from the beginning, 1949, it's an aggressive organization. So there is no doubt that NATO is responsible in all wars that they are engaged. But of course, I have, you know, it is not black and white for, yeah. for me. And I think, of course, NATO provoked Russia, for sure, for many years. They were trying their best to isolate Russia. But I think that there is the other part of the story mm-hmm. is Russia entered to the borders of another country.
Yeah.
So, of course, I'm not saying that all country, all parts are equal responsible, and I'm living in a NATO country, NATO member country, and we are focusing on the aggression of NATO. We are trying to avoid any further acceleration of war. For example, today we learned that the engagement rules in Baltic Sea were changed by NATO. And this is one of the outcomes of the NATO summit. And now they say that we are going to shoot any Russian plane without any warning.
Yeah, good luck with that. But by the way, and one of the things you didn't mention, and you did say NATO is supposed to be a defense alliance, right?
It's a lie.
Atlantic. Right, because what do you call the bombing of Belgrade? What do you call the bombing and invasion of Iraq? What do you call the attacks for 20 years in Afghanistan? What do you call the involvement in Syria and Libya? This is not defense. This is offense. This is aggression, right? Am I crazy?
Always. Yeah. Always. And they also, it's not related only with the real wars. It is related with attacking people. They organize military corps in some countries, including my country. You know, two successful and one unsuccessful military corps in Turkey mm-hmm. were related by NATO. It is documented.
Yeah.
And they killed a lot of people. Not only in Turkey, in Italy, in Greece, the Gladio organization. So NATO is the biggest and the most dangerous terrorist organization in the world, for sure.
So what happens then? Let's go back to my original question. I'm fascinated by this. Like I said at the beginning, the Europeans seem hell-bent on some kind of aggression with Russia. I don't think they're thinking this through very well because Russia is a pretty powerful country and they have more nuclear warheads than anybody in the world. And just their hypersonic missiles alone could do a lot of damage to a lot of European cities. So Russia has no interest in being at war with Europe as far as I can tell, unless I'm really stupid and I'm just missing it, but I don't see it. But they seem very interested in having a war with Russia. If they get their wish, let us suppose, that they're able to pull this off, as you just described with what they're doing in the Baltic states, for example, and what they're doing in places like Estonia. And there is some kind of war or conflagration or conflict between Europe and Russia. And Turkey has to decide, do they choose Europe? Do they choose Russia? Or do they abstain? What do you think?
Well, of course, it will be a struggle inside Turkey. But this government has already decided that they will function inside NATO and they are trying to get new roles. So I don't say that Turkey needs a war with Russia. But they are playing with game. And as you said, in Europe, they are not thinking in, they are not rational. You know, it is a stupid thing to accelerate the conflicts with Russia. It is crazy. But the problem is, we say that capitalism is not a rational system anymore. It's not rational. And you see the leaders. It was like a big show in Ankara.
Yeah.
But each of them were terrible. You see, you cannot see any intelligence. Nothing.
I think they're bankers. They're there to make money. And it seemed to me, or at least from what I heard or watched, that there was not a lot of interest there on the part of these leaders on administering to the welfare of their people. It seemed like they were there to do big business deals and most of all weapons contracts. And I ask
can
myself,
can I tell you something?
Yeah,
in this direction.
Go ahead.
You see, for example, the U.S. delegation were more than 1,000. Most of them were businessmen.
Yeah.
Mainly on defense industry.
Correct.
And Ankara during this week was like an big, huge exhibition center.
Yes, I reported on that yesterday. I showed a video. I was like, I watched the meetings, and they were all about weapons. It was nothing about the people. It was all weapons and war and deals and a billion for you and a million for me and and another million for him. And it was like I was going, what the hell is this? This is
exactly, exactly. Crazy. And you see, the final declaration is very short.
Yeah.
When compared to other summits, so they don't deal with political issues.
Yeah.
Their main idea is to get more and more weapons. And this is terrible because we know the consequences.
Kamal, you have been a delight to talk to. Thank you, my friend, for sharing your ideas. I've always had a lot of questions about Turkey's role. Where are they in all of this? And I think you are keenly aware and able to represent this because you're not in the establishment, you're kind of outside the establishment, but you're still a Turk, and you consider yourself somebody who understands the Turkiya point of view, as you all well presented. Thank you, my friend. If somebody wants to get a hold of you or reach out to you, what can they do?
I have an email, for example.
Perfect. They can find you on the internet, as we say.
And I have some social media accounts, so no problem. They can reach me. If somebody wants to, through my party, Communist Party of Turkey.
Kamal Akıyan.
They can reach me.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you for a great conversation.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being so gracious with your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's it for us. You can obviously find part of this conversation as we place it in different social media sites and then ask you for your opinion. I mean, do you agree with him? Do you agree with me? Do you not agree, which is perfectly fine? You can find us obviously on X and on Spotify and on YouTube and on BitChute, where I have lately found is the best place to make sure you're not demonetized, that nobody can make you disappear or make your content disappear. So check it out, BitChute.com. Okay, thanks so much for being with us. I'll be looking for you again next time. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes. I'm Rick Sanchez. Good night.